Welcome to the New York Times Podcast, your Even My Sweater of Music News and Criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
Sometimes I shouldn't text you. You act just like my ex does. You know I try my best.
You are bouncing and bopping along to I Want to Slam My Head Against the Wall. That is Glaive. Glaive, as many of you likely know, but some of you maybe are not aware, Glaive is one of the emergent breakout stars of the scene slash sound slash playlist slash questionable umbrella term hyperpop that has been gaining currency in the last year and a half. Glaive is, I think he's 16 or maybe 17 now. He's still in high school. He's got three EPs, two solo, one collaborative. And I think he's one of the most fascinating and fun and engaging singer-songwriters working in any genre today. I know it's a little bit less popular than Taylor Swift, but sometimes podcast has to put you on. So we're going to spend this episode talking about Glaive, his rise during Corona and during pandemic, and also kind of problematize the idea of hyperpop a little bit. To do that, I'm joined by Alex Robert Ross. He's the editorial director of The Fader. Alex, what's good, man?
How you doing, John? It's great to be here.
I'm so happy to have you. Also, just as a quick sidebar, Alex was good enough to send me an old Aaliyah interview that I did for The Fader, which I'm sure is in a storage unit somewhere, but you found it going through old issues, and I was grateful for that. I think I mentioned that on the Aaliyah podcast, but here you are, the man himself. So thank you. How's everything at The Fader, first of all? How's Fader things?
Things are going great, thanks. Yeah, we're just like everybody right now, just trying to put off thinking about end of year and the chaos that ensues there. But otherwise, everything's great.
Alex, let's get into Glaive. Let's start with biography, first of all. Tell me a little bit about Glaive. Is he 16 or 17 now?
He's very much 16. And he makes a point of that himself. When I spoke to him a little while back, he said, yeah, one thing that's crazy is I'm not 16 about to turn 17, man. I'm 16 and I was 15 and I'm just 16.
Wow.
He's very aware of it. Yeah.
I also just had a birthday.
Happy birthday.
I too am going to hold on to the age that I just was rather than the age that I eventually shall be. So thank you, Glaive, for that inspiration. Glaive's from a small town in North Carolina near Asheville. When you did your interview with him, you did an interview with him for the Fader podcast. You guys talked a little bit about his hometown. Get people involved with where Glaive is from. We'll get to where he is, but let's talk about where he's from.
He's actually originally from Florida. He moved up to Hendersonville, North Carolina, a few years ago with his mom. Hendersonville is, you know, pretty typical by the sounds of it, pretty typical suburban Carolina, population of about 10,000, and like a lot of kids, slightly alternative kids in that part of the world. He's sort of a little bit of an outcast, you know, didn't really get along with a lot of other kids, like a lot of conservatism around there, and he just wasn't really into that scene.
I forget if it was in your interview or maybe the Vulture interview where he talks about how he goes to the kind of gifted and talented school, and the kids at that school are like, whatever, dude, like, we don't care that you're famous now. But the kids at the local school are like, oh, Glaive. Like, so kind of telling a little bit about what he's been coming up around. I think the music business changed less than people anticipated that it would kind of in the wake of the corona. Obviously, touring is one thing, but I mean in terms of sounds. But an interesting thing that happened last year was you did feel this coalescing start to happen in terms of what came to be understood as hyperpop. That phrase was in light currency previously. But let's talk about kind of like 2019 into 2020. Where was that world coming from? And were people actively trying to like throw darts and hit a bullseye on a sound? Or did it kind of get umbrellaed onto a bunch of loosely related stuff?
I think a little from column A, a little from column B. If you were to tell the history of hyperpop over the last few years, you know, you would probably have to go back to 100 Gex and the explosion that the Money Machine created when that single went kind of viral.
We're just clapping for 100 Gex as we do at least twice a week in my home office. Just clapping for 100 Gex. Absolutely.
You've got to.
Let's listen to a little Gex. It's a classic. You know it. You love it. Here's Money Machine. Here's
jail, I've been trying to go to bed. Hiding up the days, I'm trying to get it right. Said it all before, I'm starting once again. I'm better off alone. Tell me what you do.
You can see the method of communication is completely different. There's these kids getting together on Discord and SoundCloud and message boards and trading music like that. And I was watching an interview with the artist Midwest, and he was talking about, you know, when he was on Discord servers for the first time, meeting producers, and one of them was from Philadelphia and another one was from Vietnam. And they were all trading files like that. Now, I know that this is, you know, hardly a brand new story in pop music, sort of borderless idea, but that really did start to have that method of communication really changed, and it went to a social media that's sort of out of reach of our generation to some extent. And then 2019 going into 2020, you obviously get the formation of the hyperpop playlist on Spotify in 2019, which really starts to codify this. And I think Ben Dandridge-Lemko did an excellent piece at the Times about that.
Shout out Ben, of course. And I think one of the things that Ben touches on in that piece is the anxiety that some of these kids, and I say that term literally, I know I call a lot of people kid, but like literally these kids are feeling, where you've been making music in your house, maybe you're communicating with people on these kind of decentralized social media or social communication platforms. And then all of a sudden, this thing that you've been doing in private, we're going to put a big spotlight on it and we've got a name for it. That's got to be a little disorienting. And there's in Ben's piece, there's certainly some anxiety, I believe, like expressed by Glaive and others about, is that what I do? Do we even call it that? Do I want to call it that? Should I be targeting that?
That's a familiar story, right? I mean, it's hard to find any artist in most genres who will proudly take on, I mean, you take emo or pop, anything, but most people tend to want to reject those sort of labels. But what's interesting, I think, without getting too into the weeds too early about Spotify.
That's all right. Get in the weeds. Get in the weeds.
This one's for the heads, right? Yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. If you've made it to minute 9 of this episode, like you're here. You're here for the deep stuff.
Exactly. This is something that I've spoken to Shad D'Souza about, who's pretty great on this stuff. And it's, you know, rather than, yes, this is a ground up movement, a group of musicians, however disparate and however spread out across the world they are, but it's top down in the sense that a major corporation with huge influence on the industry effectively started this and got the ball rolling on it. And a lot of these musicians, you know, Osquin, Ben spoke to for the Times piece, and that was pretty soon after A.G. Cook had done a guest curation of the Spotify playlist, and he'd put on like Kate Bush and stuff. And the feeling about that was not necessarily that it was messing with the sanctity of the genre, but that the people at the top of that playlist who got bumped off in favor of Kate Bush were relying on the Spotify paycheck.
Yes, although to be fair, a Spotify paycheck that hadn't existed 6 months prior to that. So, you know, it's all, it's a gift until it's not a gift. It's not a gift until it is a gift. I want to be fair to all parties involved here. Absolutely. I'm sure it felt real that all of a sudden this thing was being taken away that had been, but of course, I'm sure it felt just as unreal when that thing was given X amount of months prior.
Well, and you know, I don't want to sound at all patronizing here, but we do have to reinforce how young a lot of these people are. They are kids, as you say, and 6 months or a year when you're 15 or 16 is
a whole lifetime.
Huge. Yeah. So if you've been making that, if you've been getting that check for 6-7 months, that's a lot of your life. And that feels like it's going to be the rest of your life. I assume. I barely remember what it's like to be that age. But so
I personally barely remember what I did 4 days ago. No less have any context about 6 months. So yeah, I feel you.
That's definitely one interesting thing that's at play here, which is that these kids who were doing, and there's still so much diversity in the scene, it almost feels weak to call it a scene as such. It's just kids on the internet making music. But Spotify bringing it under that umbrella has really been the catalyst for everything.
Let's listen to some Glaive from, I believe, the wee months of 2020, about five lifetimes ago. Let's listen to Sick. This is very early Glaive. So much bullshit, I can't stand it. I've been going crazy lately, I've been going mad. And ask me how I do it, baby, I don't know I'm mad. I'm wasting all my time and I'm wasting all the blood. I'm sick, yeah, I'm overstimulated. Drones in my brain for information. Cheap, cheap jokes. Sick is one of the first, I believe, Glaive songs. I think it was first uploaded to SoundCloud. Eventually, all his stuff migrated over to Spotify. I remember this from the SoundCloud rap era, like the Pump and Smoke Perp, that kind of like early X, that kind of era, that the actual migration of the catalog off of SoundCloud onto traditional streaming platforms or bigger streaming platforms is in and of itself a metric of the success of what they're doing. And it seems like Glaive experienced something similar of uploading a bunch of stuff on SoundCloud, finding community there. And then whether it was the manager or the Interscope deal or whatever, all of a sudden everything got legitimized and moved over to Spotify and Apple.
So that was about a year ago, I think, that process took place. And since then it sort of skyrocketed. We covered Glaive. Colin Joyce wrote a fantastic feature on him, a Jenna feature last year. And I think that was just before things had started to move over to Spotify. And then since then, it's just been a pure upward trajectory. He's been in the studio with Travis Barker. He's, you know, the finest engineers that money can buy in Los Angeles while still having to attend school and post IG lives of himself sitting through history class.
Joe Coscarelli, my colleague, my beloved friend, sent me a screen grab of a Glaive IG story. It was just a text post and it said, "Why do I need to take the PSAT if I'm going to make music? The f*** that's got to do with me."
And he's right to some extent. Yeah, exactly. you can't take that away from him.
Relatable energy.
Yeah.
Look, Glaive also, that said, seems like the type of kid who probably do pretty well on the PSATs. Just putting that out there. On the Lyrical Lemonade interview that he did, he talked about being good in English. And the hosts were kind of like ribbing him about being a good student. So, you know, I bet he'd do well on the PSATs, but it does seem unlikely that that's going to be a meaningful thing for his future.
Kind of sidebar on this, but I thought that Lyrical Lemonade interview was so funny that they...
I loved it.
Like, they were like, "So what did you think of whatever it is, like Mrs. Smith, your teacher?" And he's like, "Yo, f*** her, man. I can't stand her." And then he's like, "Well, she's actually got nothing but nice things to say about you. We called her." That's brilliant.
Yeah, I thought that was, it had a little bit of Nardwuar energy, that interview, which I thought was really good. Like, I did a thing, actually, for the Fader, of all places, like one of the only freelance pieces I've written while I was at the Times, which was the Fader 100th issue, and it was about the death of First. And I meant it sort of about, like, commenting, but it's also about how, like, just the internet is so vast that, like, for people like us, who are like, "Oh, we're on this early." And that used to be kind of like calling card. You just can't possibly be first anymore, or certainly not consistently across the board. It's almost impossible. So I've come to appreciate scene specific interviews or journalists or, you know, or video series that are early, but also very, very, very detailed in a way that you kind of only can be if all you're paying attention to is like Glaive and six other people on SoundCloud. That's really fun. Like, that reminds me of how I was like 15 years ago, you know, but it's like, you can't be that way forever about all things. So I'm always very grateful when I stumble upon something like that, where I'm like, "Oh, early, maybe not first, but early, but also super, super micro detailed." Anyway, that was like a very roundabout way of saying good interview.
Yes. Agreed.
Wait, did we play Astrid? I don't think we played Astrid.
We didn't, no.
All right, we gotta play Astrid. Let's get it in. From the heart. Yeah, you look so pretty in that dress, but I look bad, so I gave you everything I ever had, even my sweat, so mood is always shitty like North Carolina weather. Saying that you're better than my ex, but have you met her? Astrid, one of my songs of last year, one of the Fader songs of last year. It's a big, quote unquote, big Glaive record. What does that mean in the real world? I think on Spotify, maybe it's got 15 million streams, but compared to his other songs, that's a lot. And that's certainly a lot for something coming out of this scene. Astrid, just super, super Sugar Rush, big, big, big bouncy energy. And also you're seeing and hearing Glaive as a songcraft person. A lot of his songs do have kind of a similar structure. He does have kind of like a rhythm within the songs, but you're getting a lot of song structure. Talk to me about hearing Glaive and his emergence as songwriter, not just kind of like aestheticized, but also songwriting.
Astrid was, I think, the first song I heard of his. So I would have been like last April or so, last May. And I was sort of blown away by it. I think it's a perfect example of what makes him so compelling. You're right about the fact that, yeah, there is a pattern to his songwriting. There is a challenge at fitting in too much complexity in maximum 2 minutes. Like, all of his songs are very short, and there's a really easy way to read that, which is, you know, that's what kids do nowadays. I don't think that's necessarily true. They can also spend 2-7 hours on Twitch. So I think attention spans are fine. But he does manage to fit a huge amount of energy and, more than anything, melody. He has like a preternatural, I think, sort of ability to craft melody in a way that feels effortless. I mean, he wrote that when he was 15. What fascinated me about Astrid, though, it was Astrid and I think Arsenic came out around the same time, I think. But Astrid starts with that guitar line, which Colin Joyce in his Gen F piece at a Fader described as like hearing an American football song played back at the wrong speed, which is absolutely bang on. So I read an interview with him recently where he said, yeah, I have actually listened to American football. And
okay, that's interesting. I didn't see that, but that's interesting.
Because for a while I figured this was a little bit sort of Lil Nas X with Panini, that he just genuinely had never heard In Bloom and so didn't know how to copy it, because why would he listen to In Bloom by Nirvana, right? Like, just hadn't come across it. It turns out that Glaive is aware of that stuff. But also that the first American football LP came out 6 years before he was born or something.
Generationally, when it comes to music, like, we tend to think of a band like American football in its specific context. What year, what scene, what sound. So many of those things are so completely disaggregated by the internet and by online consumption, that it's possible to embrace American football or the idea of American football without even necessarily understanding the broader context of American football. You know, you think about the classic sampling of, like, you know, hip hop sampling of soul music in the 80s and 90s. So much of that is very deliberate callback to parents' generations, to music of one's childhood, to making a case for hip hop as part of a larger Black music lineage. I do think a lot of that contextualized sampling is going away. And you talk about Lil Nas X, you think about what he did on Old Town Road. I mean, here's this kind of just like random, like, store brand Trent Reznor thing that he just like finds on the, you know, it's like found, or that Keo found on the internet or whatever. There's no story there. There's no, like, I wanted to tell a thing about a continuum between Nine Inch Nails and Trent. Like, it's not that. It's just like, yeah, it sounded vibey.
Yeah, he heard a banjo and was like, cowboys, that's what that means to me. Yeah,
exactly. And it could have been any band. Could have been Earl Scruggs. You know what I mean? Like, could have been anything. It just happened to be that. So I tend to resist like the overreads. Although, you know, when I spoke with Nothing Nowhere a few years ago, he was extremely well-versed in that stuff, but I think the music that he's making is much more considered in that tradition. Whereas I think, you know, if you're 15, you might just be grabbing it like, oh yeah, parched guitar, great, let's just rock with that, and not necessarily thinking of like the 25 years of lineage that goes with it.
One interesting thing with that is, I'm not sure if I'm overreaching with the way that I've tried to think about this over the last year or so. But yeah, I mean, yes, this, it's all collapsed, right? These influences, these sort of totems of music history and lineage have been collapsed by this generation, because everything is very readily accessible and you can just go with a vibe. I do think that some of them are really well versed in music history and lineage, but not necessarily in the way that the we might be, or the people of our generation might be. It's just different, and it might be like a weirder grab bag.
Yeah, it's learning stuff backwards is different than learning it forwards. I mean, it's like how I think about jazz, you know, the jazz of the 60s and 70s, which is like I have specific things that are fascinating to me, but I couldn't necessarily tell you exactly where they land in like the overall history. So I try to be sympathetic to folks who are learning backwards about the stuff that I learned forwards. I think that's the kind of key thing.
Obviously, somebody who is foundational to this sound who we haven't brought up yet is Sophie. And after Sophie passed away at the beginning of this year, there was that the clip went round from a documentary where she talked about, with a synth, why would you try and make it sound like a guitar from the 70s? Why would you try and recreate a sound of another synthesizer or an organ from another time? We have the ability to completely break this free of history and context and create sounds that are effectively limitless. And that's something that she did. And I think you can see, whether it's conscious or not, I think you can see that in a lot of the kids who are making this music now is, yeah, sort of not, even if it's not intentional, removing it from that historical context. And also, and at the same time, removing it from all context entirely and just making sound that sounds good, because that's what possibility and freedom feels like for them.
It's been a long time since I felt possibility or freedom, but yes, conceptually, I believe that what you're saying is accurate. Yes.
Well, and you know, this is probably a step too far, and I'm maybe getting a little bit heady in a bad way. But when you're 16, or if you're 30, or if you're 70, if you're locked inside for, I wasn't implying you were 70, John, just so you know.
I want to say, I should clarify, I look good for 70. I look pretty good for 70. Yeah. Everyone tells me I look pretty good for 70, so it's totally fine.
But I think that when you're trapped inside for a year or more and barely allowed to go outside, probably the idea that something can be limitless, that one of your senses can engage with something that's completely limitless, it is extremely liberating. And I think that's not just a reason why people started creating this music, but one of the reasons that people were listening to it more over the last 18 months or so.
All these Lucy singles, they got pulled together on an EP last year. It's called Cypress Grove. Really, really good. And then there's this Interscope deal, which I believe that's part of. He signed to a 2-EP Interscope deal, which also symbolizes how fast things move now. Because, you know, if I'm a major label, I'm kind of grasping at any little micro movement that makes sense on the internet and hope that we might be able to at some point like extract maximum hit value from it. Glaive's an interesting case because Glaive is writing songs that are very, very poppy. They are poppy. They're distorted. They're obviously like from a what instruments he's using perspective. Obviously, it's not down the middle pop mainstream, but structurally, he really does understand how to put hooks, bridges, you know, melodies, all that stuff you mentioned before. It's very preternatural. He has a gift for it. So if I was a major label, I'd be like, huh, okay, well, let's get, you know, let's extract this person's labor value as fast as possible.
That's, you know, obviously just a sign of a gold rush. I think on Cypress Grove, you could obviously see, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense, but you could see the edges sort of slightly being sanded down there just a little bit. Sometimes when you sand down edges, it really does bring out beauty as well. It's not always a bad thing.
Of course. I like pop music.
Yeah.
I like music by committee. Damn it.
Well, and this is the thing. You're not forcing a square peg into a round hole with this one, right? With Glaive, you're not taking somebody who was making extremely experimental music and trying to make him do like the most straightforward stuff. But he grew up listening to pop radio, you know, especially women singers like Ariana Grande and just like all the stuff that you would expect from pop radio. So he just sort of has that built into him. And he's quite consciously, I think, making pop music. But yeah, Cypress Grove. So that would have been, and was that the back end of last year or was that the beginning of this year?
It was maybe like November, October, November of last year.
And then you can start seeing that, you know, the way they rolled that out, everything was a lot more professional. You start getting like much nicer press pictures and things like that. And I think Cypress Grove was really, the way that it felt was sort of like consolidation in a good way. They were consolidating and trying to push it a little bit further, but really consolidating on that sort of viral success of the first singles, however muted that viral success might actually have been in the real world.
Now, this year, second EP, All Dogs Go to Heaven, we played I Want to Slam My Head Against the Wall at the top. This EP feels really coherent to me. Also, to your point, a little bit sanded at the edges, but in a way that I think serves what he's doing. You know, it feels like a promising early document of a soon-to-be very ambitious talent. That's how it reads.
Yes. Absolutely. The song that really struck me from was the title track. That felt like a real departure in his sound, in to an extent with the songwriting, but that might be like one of his best hooks, if not his best hook. When I interviewed him around the album, he was talking about sounds that were tasteful, and he seemed to equate being tasteful with like organic textures.
Yeah, you did get into that in your interview. Yeah, talk about that, because I think it was an interesting choice of adjective for someone coming from a scene. I don't want to say that the scene is untasteful, but it is loose. It's a little like fly by the seat of your pants. It's acidic in a way. And I wonder if tasteful was his way of saying, in essence, I'm toning down the chirps, the whirs, the burrs, the serratedness. Is that kind of what you think he was getting at?
I think it was that. I also think that this is, it's a slightly, I don't want to speak for him, but the impression I got and the way that he was explaining it to me was, it's kind of attritional as much as anything else. I think that that came up at a point in our conversation when we'd been talking about what it was like to suddenly be sort of ripped out of, like plucked out of a suburb in North Carolina and flown over to LA to work in huge studios with like Nick Mirra and Travis Barker and people like this. And I was asking him if it becomes difficult to say no to people and things, to say when you've got eight people in the studio instead of just you in a bedroom, to say, no, I don't want to do that. Stop that. This is my vision. These are my songs. I'm doing this. And he seemed pretty like clear-headed about that. He was really, you know, he understood what was going on. And he was saying, the impression I got was that there had been pressure, or whenever he'd felt any pressure, it had been from people trying to make things glitchier. He used EDM as the other side of the coin to taste, like that as the opposite of tasteful. I don't think he meant it in a disparaging way to EDM, but it felt like when he was in a studio, people were trying to make him.
He didn't want to undermine his eventual Illenium collaboration. Is
exactly,
that what you're saying?
Exactly. Okay.
Illenium, if you're listening, Glaive would be happy to work with you. Sure.
As you say, Interscope have signed this kid, and they've signed a hyperpop kid, I think, as far as they're concerned. And maybe Rebellion in that moment does look like, I'm going to do this big acoustic song with like gang chant choruses.
Maybe this is a good moment to talk about, is hyperpop BS? It does feel like the term itself is unstable. And I wonder if, we talked about this a little bit on the phone yesterday when we were kind of pre-gaming, the instability of this scene is in part because it isn't a literal scene in the regional sense. It's barely a literal scene in the it's a stable group of people sense. And it's not really a scene in a pure sonic sense. There are people doing overlapping things, but it's not Los Angeles rap production of the early 90s where, you know, it's the same five people producing for everybody in a room, some in the like just three different rooms. It's not quite like that. Do you think that all of those uncertainties cast a little bit of a shadow onto the idea of hyperpop, just standalone, the idea?
Yeah, I mean, inevitably, one word that keeps coming up with hyperpop is when people write about it, they seem to, you know, this is an underground artist. I'm thinking like, there's no ground for them to be under. There's nothing physical here. We're talking about something completely, you know, ethereal, basically. not in that it doesn't have longevity, just in the fact that it doesn't really exist anywhere.
It's funny because it's not really in contrast. You know, we think about classic quote unquote undergrounds of the 80s or 90s. They're usually in contrast to slash reaction to an overground. And maybe you can sort of loosely contend that Gex are in dialogue with some overground, maybe. Although I think it's vague. If anything, I think that their engagement with like the quote unquote overground is actually more like scavenging it for trash and repurposing it more so than acting out against it. But in this case, certainly, you know, in the case of Glaive and the others, certainly not. It doesn't feel that way.
I love that description of Gex. That's such a good way of putting what they do, scavenging for trash in pop music. It's beautiful. I mean, I guess if you wanted an easy example of the way that does cross, it would be probably Charlie XCX. And, you know, so you'd have to dig a little bit deeper into the history with PC music and stuff. But, you know, Charlie XCX is somebody who can go to the top of the charts on a track with Iggy Azalea and then can also make Vroom Vroom, which I can totally get how at the time you're listening to that and thinking these sentences do not make sense when they're put together. The words just about rhyme. That's the only thing that seems to be going for the lyrics. And it's acerbic and it's difficult and it's challenging in a weird way. And it would have been hard to see that becoming a huge influence on another generation. I mean, that's probably as foundational to this scene as Thousand Gex, as a standalone piece of work. So I guess that is the interaction with that part of the scene. And there are people in the scene, Glaive chief among them, who could definitely interact with the mainstream by just moving into it, by getting tracks on the Billboard charts. You can absolutely see that for some of those people, sort of recreating Charlie's pop star image and reality. I can see that. But yeah, sorry, to go back to the thing about the underground, I suppose it is underground in that sense. Yeah, that there is, that, you know, this exists on a Spotify playlist that currently has 250,000, I think, followers, but with an extremely high engagement rate, which, you know, compares very favorably to other playlists they have going there. So you might have whatever it is, 15 million on Rap Caviar, but far fewer people are saving those songs every week. So that would suggest that in a very 2021 kind of way, you've got a real sort of, I guess, cult following for this, a really passionate cult following.
It feels to me like ideology. It feels to me like, I mean, look, all classes have been virtual for the last, 12 months or 16 months, right? It's like, why can't your scene be virtual? Why can't your identity formation be virtual? I mean, it's, identity formation is virtual in so many other parts of the internet and so many other, and frankly, way more literal ways, avatars and whatnot. So why wouldn't you have identity formation that's like purely existing in a digital space where you engage with a playlist and it tells you about who you are? It's totally fine. But what does that mean for the idea of hyperpop as a music, as an idea? Is hyperpop an umbrella term and things underneath it will continue to change and mutate, but we will always refer to it as hyperpop? Or is hyperpop something that we will think of as a relic of a very specific 2018 to 2021 sonic moment, and then as folks like Glaive and others kind of move more into the mainstream, or hell, graduate high school, we'll think, huh, okay, well, that happened, and now it's not happening. Where do you think the term is going to go?
Predictions are difficult, but like I think you could look back at PC music could actually be quite informative for this. I mean, even before hyperpop, before Spotify built this playlist, PC music was still something that certainly, like in our jobs, we still thought about and talked about and discussed. It was still something that we were conscious of. And the people who came out of it, that's Sophie, A.G. Kirk, you know, Danielle Hall, Charlie. And the, what they were doing now, well, in recent years, wasn't necessarily directly tied. We weren't still calling it PC music, right? We didn't listen to that Sophie record and say, oh yeah, PC music artist Sophie. That would have been a little weird that many years later. So I think you're going to see this splinter inevitably. There are too many people making this music, and its boundaries were always too
unsteady,
completely unsteady. And it's a very, very good and accurate way. It's a very good genre name, but it can't hold for that long. I think you're already seeing that on the playlist.
But here's something that I've been thinking about, which is when you think about the maximalist pop of the last few years, and I don't necessarily strictly mean down the center mainstream pop, but occasionally, a lot of the exuberance that I've come to associate with, you know, whether it's Gex or post-Gex hyperpop, I also think about it a lot in terms of K-pop. You know, I think you hear it certainly in some of the better BTS songs, not the more maudlin recent ones. You certainly are getting it with aespa and other kinds of groups. Like, there is this kind of almost like a brittle, jagged exuberance that I see popping up elsewhere. And I wonder if when we get to the down the center pop of, let's say, 5 years from now, is it going to carry residue of what Glaive is doing, what Gex is doing, what's happening in other countries? It's what's happening with K-pop. Or is that going to somehow end up in like whoever the mainstream American pop star of 2027 is?
Oh, yeah. And I would be surprised if we don't see it sooner than that. The obvious way for this to happen is for like a mainstream pop star to make a quote unquote hyperpop song, right?
Like Bieber to kind of like try to hang a hat on this or something.
Exactly. And that would open the floodgates a little bit. And yeah, you could see how that would, yeah, it would have good and bad effects, I'm sure. But you mean like if the energy that we're seeing now is going to still have anything left of itself in like 5 years' time, if that the aesthetic and the vibe.
Yeah, or if it's going to just be totally absorbed and be like, in essence, meta-referential. There will be people who experience it only through a Billboard number one hit of 2027 that have never heard the word Glaive, you know? That's what I'm curious about.
That's entirely plausible. I can definitely see how that would be the case. I do just think that some of what was the term you used the about the energy of what's going on at the exuberance?
Oh, like a brittle, jagged exuberance.
Yes, a brittle, jagged exuberance. This might be overly simplistic, but like, is that not what you have when you're 16?
Yeah,
like this sort of awkward, like weird, very angry, but kind of ironic. And just hormones everywhere, exhausting amounts of hormones. Like that's the music that 16-year-olds make if they're doing it well. That'll maintain as long as younger people are still making music. And by 2027, Glaive can be making his, you know, late era Bob Dylan records because he'll be like 22 right. By then.
Early retirement for Glaive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Speaking of 16-year-olds making music, so one of the things that you were talking to Glaive about in your interview was, he was in LA at the time you were talking to him, and he was staying in an Airbnb with Eric DOA and maybe some others. And I assume, you know, in the studio, you mentioned he had previously been in with Nick Mira. He'd been in with Travis Barker, who among us has not been in with Travis Barker this year. I've got an EP coming out pretty soon on Columbia. Shout out Ron Perry. So he, you know, he's still like churning out these songs. Him and Eric DOA have an EP that came out recently, Then I'll Be Happy is the name of it. I don't like it quite as much as All Dogs Go to Heaven, but I think there's some really good stuff on this. But there's an interesting song on this that I think maybe portends, or foretells, I should say, a potential future. And that song is called Pretending. Let's listen to that. I feel like I'm dying. I can't be mindless. I don't want to see. So here's a disco record, right? Here's a Dua Lipa song. not quite, but not quite. I was pretty struck by how directional this song was. It is not reflective of what the rest of the EP sounds like. The rest of the EP sounds much more like the previous Glaive solo stuff. But this was an interesting wrinkle, I thought. how did you receive this EP, whether this song or just in general, in the sort of overall Glaive arc? How did it strike you?
I think that you're now starting to see an arc, and it's still pretty, it's not a huge amount of data to build that graph with, right? But if you are starting to see an arc here, yeah, Pretending is an interesting track. I think the two songs that really jump out as well, Cloak and Dagger and Fuck This Town, and to an extent, Mental Anguish, the second track on the record, but they stand out not in the same way that Pretending is actually an interesting song, but in the way that you can, like, I can see this racking up like however many dozens of millions of YouTube hits, right? This is a much poppier album. That's a very long way of saying this is a pretty straightforward pop album. To put my critic's hat on with it.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it.
Yeah, that is the point of the podcast, right? I forgot about that. I think that this seems really silly, but I think this EP kind of falls down on the fact that Eric DOA and Glaive sound quite similar.
Yes.
And I want to be able to pull them apart more. And I'm starting to sense that that's happening in the music as much as it is in the vocals. It's not off-putting, right? It's not horrible. It's just, you don't get the sense that these are two people bringing like wildly different voices.
Yeah, I totally feel that. I think, you know, as I was listening to it kind of with a sharper, like more discerning ear, it's like you realize like Glaive is like, the vocals are a little bit more melty, and Eric DOA, the vocals are a little bit more rhythmic in delivery. But I know what you mean. It's not a best of both worlds. It's a best of the same world, kind of.
Yes, there are benefits to that. But definitely in terms of the arc of Glaive's career, Eric DOA is to an extent. But in the arc of Glaive's career, this is probably, you would expect, this is the kind of thing that's setting him up for an actual push at the mainstream. And for maybe trying to make an assault on charts. I mean, these are songs that feel like they were designed to be just like absolutely smashed after school. Well, after you've clocked off history.
When we think about like where Glaive might go, you know, it's interesting. He's kind of like fallen in with the Lyrical Lemonade crew a little bit, which I think, again, this was touched on the Vulture piece. You know, what Glaive does is not necessarily, it's not really hip hop, and certainly at all, it maybe is like post Juice World in a way, but I wouldn't think of it as hip hop. But like in 2021, like it's all the same anyway, you know? So he's like falling in with that crew. Shout out Zach Bia. Zach Bia, you know, put him on at a party and said, hey, come through, sing a song, you know, King of the Youth. So he's like, he's plugged in there. At what point is Glaive just a super chill, lanky teen pop star with great painted nails and just a bunch of undeniable smash hit songs? Is that where we're going?
Have we talked about the fact that he's really tall? I feel like that's important in a way that people don't. He's really tall.
Like how tall? I've seen photos, but like I know he seems like lanky, but I didn't know how tall he was.
I haven't stood next to him. So maybe you have to get the New York Times fact-checking department on this before I libel somebody.
We'll call research.
I think he's like 6'7" or something.
What?
But he's a tall guy.
He's six. Oh my God.
I think he's very tall.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
We got to get Kentai Haven on it. That TikTok kid. We got to get that TikTok kid on it. Oh, wow. I didn't know that. I guess I would have assumed from photos like 5'11 to 6'1", but
no, I think he's really tall. Yeah. If I'm mistaken, I take it back.
Tall people are thriving. So I guess he's just going to be a superstar. I guess there's nothing you can do about it.
You are right about that. I mean, he's probably, hopefully, just going to be a chill, tall, rather than lanky guy who's just, making smash hits, doing well for himself. And hopefully he really doesn't actually need trigonometry. And he has a career just being excellent at this. And he manages to like avoid the pitfalls, which is something that you hope with all artists at this age. I mean, you and I talked a little bit yesterday about Khalid, who had a similar sort of, and that would not be the jagged sort of ebullience of youth. I think that was a lot less jagged, but a similar thing. Lots of use of, I guess Glaive uses the first person where Khalid uses the third person. But there, a similar sort of thing there. And Khalid, to his credit, has just sort of mellowed into that lifestyle and just appears on songs.
But also I think the Khalid case is an interesting thing when someone who is associated with a sound but is actually not quite of a sound kind of gets put into the major label system where it's like, well, now you got to do a collaboration with this guy. And now you got to do a collaboration with this girl. And now you got to do a collaboration with this group and so on and so forth. And when there's no core purpose, it's so easy to just evaporate. And I think that's kind of what's happened with Khalid. I don't think that will happen with Glaive, I hope. But, you know, I would love to be able to look back on this episode a year or 2 years from now and be like, ha ha, we were right.
It will depend on his forthrightness in being able to turn down.
Stand his ground.
Yeah, exactly. That applies in the studio, but that also applies in his personal life. I mean, I'm not saying anything that anybody doesn't know, right? I mean, he needs to be guided well, and he needs people not taking advantage of him. And he's clearly very talented at making his own sounds and making his own beats and picking collaborators and picking good people. So as long as he can keep doing that, then he should be all right.
So if anyone who's listened, who is involved in the career of Glaive, has made it this far in the podcast, what we would like to say to you is leave it alone. Let it be. Yeah. It's going fine.
Give him money. Give him money and a new laptop and just let him go.
Please. We entreat you. Yes, please.
That would be ideal. We were talking about the arc of Glaive with Osquin, which is, if you listen to Osquin's new album, Drive by Lullabies, I think it's called. It's excellent. It's really good. It is not necessarily what you'd call cohesive. I find it compelling. I think it's really interesting. But Quinn seems to have gotten, if anything, more experimental, a little bit stranger, really trying to test the fringes of this scene. We've established that the word scene might be misplaced, but you know, the limits of however blurry these borders are, she seems to be testing the limits of that in ways that I find really interesting. And I think if I played somebody who was not in any way aware of any of this music, the new Osquin record and the new Glaive record, and said these people started making music around a similar time and from what's largely considered the same scene, not sure that they would believe me.
It's an interesting way to go out, actually. Do you want to play something from the Osquin record to kind of underscore that?
Yes, I think we should play Can You Really Blame Me for How I React.
Great song title.
Yes. Not as good a song title as It Molds Where It Doesn't Dry Correctly, but still good.
Still good.
That's also a track on that record, but yeah.
Alex, I appreciate you coming through. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. We're going to have a mailbag episode soon-ish. Drop us an email, or I posted something in the Facebook group, put something on that post, comment on that post, get involved in the Discord, subscribe to podcasts anywhere you get your audio content, Google Play, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, whatever. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. If you want to try.